And welcome to this audio edition of Philip Huscher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Richard Caparella. Opening concerts for the season by the CSO on Thursday, September 19th and Friday, the 20th, feature guest conductor Andres Orozco Estrada and violin soloist Benjamin Beilman. The program includes Michael Tilson Thomas's Agnagram, Samuel Barber's Violin Concerto, an arrangement of the overture to Leonard Bernstein's score for West Side Story, Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet, and four dances from the ballet Estancia by Alberto Ginastera. And here are Philip Huscher's program notes on the Barber Violin Concerto, a work lasting about 25 minutes. This is not the first violin concerto to have been declared unplayable by the person for whom it was written. Tchaikovsky's now popular concerto was also rejected at first, although Leopold Auer, Tchaikovsky's chosen soloist and a violinist of considerable accomplishment, eventually had the decency to admit his error and later taught the work to his pupil Yasha Heifetz, who regularly played it. Barber was not so lucky, although time has proved the value of his work. In 1939, Barber accepted a commission from Samuel Fells, a Philadelphia businessman and the manufacturer of Fells Naphtha Soap, who wanted a violin concerto for his adopted son, Isso Briselli, a child prodigy. Briselli was born in Odessa, the birthplace of so many violinists, including David and Igor Oistrakh and Nathan Milstein. Fells offered Barber $1,000, $500 up front, $500 on completion of the score. For a composer, at the beginning of his career, it was without a doubt a good deal, or so it seemed at the time. Barber wrote the first two movements that summer in Switzerland, but when Briselli saw them, he complained that the music was too simple and not brilliant enough for a concerto. There are conflicting accounts of what happened next. According to the official story, dutifully repeated in program notes for years, Barber wrote a dazzling Perpetuum Mobile finale, which Briselli declared too difficult. Fells then asked for his money back, and Barber set up a performance to demonstrate that the movement was indeed playable and that he needn't repay the $500, which was already long spent. But in 1982, Briselli, who had no doubt sensibly given up the violin to run the Fells business, told his version of the story to Barbara Heyman, then at work on her definitive Barber biography. Briselli claimed that he had merely informed Barber that he feared the finale was too lightweight compared to the first two movements. Nonetheless, a demonstration was set up to convince Fells that his money had been well spent. This took place at the Curtis Institute, where, not incidentally, Fells served on the Board of Trustees, in the fall of 1939, before Barber had even put the finishing touches on the concerto. Herbert Baumel, a gifted Curtis student, learned the finale from Barber's manuscript in just 2 hours and played it in the studio of Josef Hoffmann, the distinguished Curtis director, before a jury that included Mary Louise Curtis Bach, the founder of the Curtis Institute, along with Hoffmann, Barber, and Barber's close friend, Giancarlo Menotti. According to Heyman, all parties immediately agreed that Barber was to be paid the full commission and Briselli had to relinquish his right to the first performance. Briselli was not present. Now, Barber was free to find a new soloist for Fells' commission. Barber took to calling it his Concerto da Sapone, or Soap Concerto, although it was becoming more of a soap opera. And so the honor of introducing this now beloved concerto fell to Albert Spaulding, a little-known violinist whose name has a secure place in the history of American music as a result. Eugene Normandy conducted the premiere with the Philadelphia Orchestra in 1941. What regularly gets lost in the story of this concerto's difficult genesis is the music itself, as direct and persuasive as anything Barber wrote. The concerto opens with one of Barber's most inspired ideas, a warm and expansive theme stated at once by the solo violin. The entire allegro is like a grand reflective aria. Even in much of its instrumental music, Barber is often a vocal composer with intermittent dramatic episodes, but one in which unabashedly romantic tonal melody reigns. The andante, in the elegiac vein of the adagio for strings, opens with a poignant oboe solo, which the violin ultimately cannot resist. In 1948, Barber changed the tempo marking of the first movement from Allegro molto moderato to a less relaxed Allegro so that the concerto would not appear to open with two slow movements. The controversial finale is neither lightweight nor unplayable, although its brilliance is not of the more predictably heroic fireworks variety. A few footnotes. Herbert Baumel, the young Curtis student whose playing testified on Barber's behalf, substituted for Spalding at the first rehearsal for the premiere, and he so impressed Ormandy that he was offered a permanent position in the Philadelphia Orchestra. When Mary Louise Curtis Bach commissioned Barber to write a work for the dedication of the new organ at the Philadelphia Academy of Music in 1960, he refused to accept the fee, reportedly $2,000, because of his longtime gratitude to her and his admiration for her motto, for quality of the work rather than quick, showy results. And finally, Barber eventually did get the remaining $500 Fels owed him. Program notes by Philip Huscher on the Violin Concerto by Samuel Barber. And now on to Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture After Shakespeare. The work lasts about 21 minutes. No other play by Shakespeare has inspired as many composers as Romeo and Juliet. Throughout the Romantic era in particular, the drama held an enormous and sometimes nearly fatal attraction. After Berlioz saw Romeo and Juliet at a Paris theater and fell desperately in love with Harriet Smithson, who played Juliet, he announced his intention to marry the actress and to write a dramatic symphony, now known as the Symphonie Fantastique, based on the play, and did both within a decade. The marriage was a mistake, however, and they later separated, but the symphony is one of his greatest works. More than 20 operas have been written on Romeo and Juliet, including Bellini's I Capuletti e I Montichi, with a mezzo-soprano as Romeo in the tradition of trouser roles, and Gounod's enduring treatment, with the ending rewritten so that the lovers die at the same moment, singing in unison. Bernstein's urban West Side Story suggests that the fascination with this subject hasn't waned in our own time. And Prokofiev's 1940 ballet is now recognized as a 20th century classic, although the composer originally wrote a happy ending because he couldn't imagine how dying lovers could dance. But none of these works has surpassed the popularity of Tchaikovsky's Fantasy Overture. The Russian composer, Mili Balakirev, apparently first suggested the play to Tchaikovsky as early as the summer of 1869. He continued to push the subject, and when Tchaikovsky wavered, he prodded him. In a letter dated October 6, 1869, he offered literary observations, suggested general guidelines for treating the subject, and even dictated four measures of music to open the work. Before Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet was finished, and it was another 10 years before it reached its final form, Balakirev had approved and rejected a number of themes, recommended a new introduction in the style of a Liszt-ian chorale, and presented his preferred tonal scheme, based on a fondness for keys with 5 flats and 2 sharps. Surprisingly, Tchaikovsky found his own voice with this work. Romeo and Juliet, a Fantasy Overture After Shakespeare, is his first masterpiece. The original version, composed in just 6 weeks, was performed in March 1870 with Nikolai Rubinstein conducting. A new version, completed that summer, incorporated Balakirev's idea of a slow chorale at the beginning. It was played in St. Petersburg in early 1872. Although Tchaikovsky and Balakirev had a falling out that year, Tchaikovsky continued to turn to Shakespeare for inspiration. In 1873, he fashioned a symphonic fantasy from The Tempest, and late in 1876, he complained of losing sleep over Othello, which he was determined to turn into an opera. He dropped the project early in the new year, 2 years before Verdi and Boito first conceived their Othello. Hamlet was the last Shakespearean subject to interest Tchaikovsky. He composed a fantasy overture on it in 1888, and 3 years later contributed incidental music to a staging of the play in St. Petersburg. In 1878, while he was recuperating from his failed marriage at his brother Modeste's house, Tchaikovsky turned to Romeo and Juliet and was struck by its potential as a great operatic subject. One night that May, when Modeste and Sasha went to the theater to see Romeo and Juliet, Tchaikovsky stayed home, put his nieces and nephews to bed, and then read the Shakespeare play for himself. "Of course, I'll compose Romeo and Juliet," he wrote to Modeste from Brailov in June, excited by the prospect of writing a new opera. "It will be my most monumental work. It now seems to me absurd that I couldn't see earlier that it was predestined, as it were, to set this drama to music." But instead of writing an opera, Tchaikovsky put the finishing touches on the Fantasy Overture 2 years later. It's this last version that is now regularly played. The idea of composing the opera cropped up in 1881 and again in 93, and on one of those occasions he sketched a duet for the lovers based on material from the Fantasy Overture, but he never orchestrated it and ultimately gave up on the project, perhaps realizing how difficult it would be to surpass his orchestral work on the same subject. Seldom in Tchaikovsky's music are form and content as well matched as in Romeo and Juliet. The contrast between family strife and the lover's passion ideally lends itself to sonata form, with two dramatically contrasted themes. The conflict assures a fierce and combative development section. Tchaikovsky begins, as Balakirev recommended, with solemn and fateful chords that suggest the calm, knowing voice of Friar Lawrence. The street music is noisy and action-packed. The famous love theme begins innocently in the English horn and violas. It was one of Tchaikovsky's boldest moves to save the big statement of this great melody, fully orchestrated and greatly extended, the way most listeners remember it, for much later at the climax of the recapitulation. The lover's music returns once again in the coda, signaled by the timpani's dying heartbeat, where it sounds cold and lifeless. Program notes by Philip Pusher on Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet. My name is Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.